This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, tempting fate with you this week as on April 13th, we record the 13th episode of the Takeout podcast, doubling up on the whole 13 thing and tempting fate. Joined as I always am by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris. Hello, Steve.
I just shattered a mirror this morning and opened an umbrella inside. Are we okay, do you think?
I think we're great. There's a black cat. What are we going to do? I don't know what we're going to do.
By the way, I'm the Shaggy to your Scooby.
In so many ways.
we will not get into, actually.
We are joined for this 13th episode of the Takeout Podcast by two of my CBS colleagues, both of them in their own right, legendary. Bob Schieffer, say hello to our audience.
Hello.
And Bob, if you would, indulge us at the top of our podcast with your killer imitation of the venerable and venerated Walter Cronkite.
Major, I have no idea why you have brought this up, but this old gray head is happy, always happy to participate and cooperate with a fellow journalist.
Walter, great to have you with us. And we're also joined at the microphones by Nancy Cordes, CBS's congressional correspondent par excellence, and my traveling colleague, though I only saw her through the television for 16 months on the campaign. She covered the Democratic nomination process, then Hillary Clinton as I chased the Republicans, and then ultimately the nominee and 45th President of the United States, Donald Trump, around the United States. Nancy, so good to have you with us.
So good to be with you in person.
I heard Nancy does a killer Walter Cronkite impression, too. No?
I can do a pretty good Bob Schieffer impression.
Okay, go for it. Let's do the roundabout. There we go.
Well, I've just never seen anything like it in my whole life. I mean, I have lived through a lot of elections, and I've just never seen anything like this.
Well done, Nancy.
You know, that became a drinking game among the younger people.
Not just the younger people, Bob.
That every time I said that on television, they had to take a shot.
Really?
And, you know, luckily we had a lot of designated drivers, so it all worked out.
And it was always true.
It was always true. Designated drivers, indeed. And drinking games are part of American life. So I'll let you know how excited we are about what's going on here with this podcast. Not only is the audience growing by leaps and bounds, but we've really expanded our booking, and we have phenomenal guests coming your way in the very near future. Next week, Carly Fiorina will be at these microphones, followed by Amy Klobuchar, our first United States Senator, Democrat from Minnesota. Jose Andres will soon be a guest on this podcast, as will comedian Frank Caliendo. All of that coming to you on the Takeout Podcast. And we're very excited about not only what the show has accomplished so far, but what we hope to accomplish in the very near future. And related to that, I got to tell you before we get into the conversation, something I am extremely excited about. Last week, we took a chance and said, you know what, if you'd like a signed Takeout Podcast sticker signed by me, do something very, very old school. We didn't even think anyone would do it, which is send to us in Washington a self-addressed stamped envelope. I mean, that's like out of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. That's how I got my decoder rings when I was a kid. We didn't think anyone would actually do that. I have for you, and you're watching on CBSN if you are, three pieces of mail delivered just yesterday, meaning Wednesday.
Sacks of mail, Major.
We don't have mail sacks yet, but we're working on it.
That's almost a whole tennis doubles team.
Exactly. And Peter Ross from Dallas, Texas, wins this week because not only did he send us a self-addressed stamped envelope, but he sent it priority mail. $6.65 shelled out so he could very rapidly get a Takeout Podcast sticker signed by me. And Steve Shigaris will tell you now, ladies and gentlemen, how to best achieve this bit of Takeout Podcast memorabilia. Steve, please.
Thanks, Major. If you would like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
Is that the Price is Right music?
That is the Price is Right. You know why?
Nancy Cordes wins.
And you know, these first ones will be like baseball cards.
They will be like baseball cards.
Can you imagine? Exactly. Think about this. Generations down the road, when grandchildren of the recipients of these stickers go on the Antiques Roadshow and say, I found this in the attic.
Right. It's going to be like, that's like a Mickey Mantle rookie card. Right.
Thousands.
If you send it priority mail, do you get two bumper stickers?
Peter Ross will get a very special gift. I guarantee you that. We are coming to you from the St. Gregory Hotel. Now, a lot of times we choose our restaurants because our guests like it. We like it. It's geographically workable for our guests. Today we're at the St. Gregory because it is geographically imperative for me to be here, because it is literally right across the street from the CBS Bureau. And in case anything happens this morning, it's Thursday morning, the 13th, I can dash across the street and get on camera, because things are unpredictable every day at the Trump White House. And so we are here at the St. Gregory. We'll have breakfast here in just a minute. But I want to talk initially with Nancy and Bob about this first 100 days of the Trump presidency. Now, Bob, we've already established that we've never seen any of this before, so that's a given. What has struck you, or the many things that may have struck you so far about the Trump presidency and what it's either done or failed to do so far?
Well, do you mean today or do you mean yesterday?
It's early.
Because it's kind of a day-to-day.
Tell me about it.
We see things that were said during the campaign that we're now saying other things. But it seems to me that if there's a trend line here right now, it is that, and Donald Trump may not appreciate me saying it, he seems to be moving more toward the political center. And how long he stays in the center lane, I have no idea. But at this point, that's what it looks like to me.
Nancy, what does it feel like day-to-day covering Congress as the Republican majority, House and Senate, interact with the Trump White House, take their cues, or either take incoming from the Trump White House?
It's a bit of a schizophrenic experience, because on one hand, they want to work with him. They need to work with him. They need him to use his bully pulpit to fire up conservative voters. They share his agenda on many issues. On the other hand, they are constantly looking to distance themselves from him, or at least ignore him when it comes to some of the things that he says that they wish he wouldn't say. And they don't want to poke the beast. And so, whereas during the campaign, at least, you would see Republican leaders condemn certain things that he said that they didn't agree with or didn't feel were proper, they don't even want to do that now, because they don't want to get on his bad side. We see what happens when you get on his bad side. You know, Steve Bannon is basically, you know, in a timeout right now over at the White House. And so there's a very delicate balance that they are trying to strike. And they'd like him to get more involved in the nitty-gritty when it comes to some of this legislation. For example, when it came to health care, he wasn't that clued in on the details, and it showed, and it made it more difficult, Republicans believe, to sell some wary conservative members whose attitude was, well, if you don't care enough to really know what's in this bill, why should I go out on a limb?
Bob, let me ask you about that. You've covered a lot of American presidents. You've watched a lot of Congresses interact with American presidents. In your assessment, is it crucial for presidents to know the nitty-gritty detail, or just set the large, broad parameters and leave the details to somebody else?
Well, they have to have the big picture, and they have to understand that that you're not dealing with a business. I can't think of how many people have come to Washington saying, we're going to change things because we're going to run it like a business. That's how they pronounce it where I come from, a business. Well, it isn't a business. No business has 535 members of the board, and that's how many members of Congress you have. The presidency is about persuasion. It's about leadership. It's not about management. But you have to find the managers to carry out the leader's plan. The great genius of Ronald Reagan was that he stuck to the big picture, but he put people in place like Jim Baker, who's one of the great politicians of our time. In all the time I've been in Washington, the three best politicians I've known about were, number one, Lyndon Johnson, whose first and by a lot. Number two, Melvin Laird, who was the Secretary of Defense for Richard Nixon. And number three was Jimmy Baker. He really knew how to push the right buttons. You've got to have that combination. So far, I have to say, Donald Trump hasn't found that yet.
Go ahead, Nancy. Here's something else you both know from covering Congress for such a long time. Members of Congress are willing from time to time to go out on a limb and get out of their comfort zone, vote for something that maybe isn't exactly what they want. But they have to feel like their own president has their back and is going to take some of the incoming if they really get slammed in their district. And right now, Republican lawmakers have seen a lot of evidence that he may not necessarily have their back, that he believes one thing one day and something else the next day, that he's on your side one day and maybe not the next. A lot of his own top advisors in the White House have had that experience. And so it makes Republicans a little skittish about doing the things that he says he needs them to do.
And we see these members going home and getting hammered from their constituents already. It's just the beginning of this administration. I guess that wasn't a reference to a drinking game. That's later.
Okay.
But it raises the question, how much patience are these members of Congress going to have continuing to go home and hearing from voters and constituents, especially when the president's not backing them up?
And by the way, this is a complaint that a lot of Democrats had during the Obama years, is that they felt that they were cut loose by the Obama White House or that the president didn't sufficiently give them cover when the heat got a little intense. But you're seeing that magnified in the
Trump era. I mean, the secret to putting together a good team is explaining to each member of the team why it is in their interest to be on the team. And that's what Lyndon Johnson was so good at. He could explain, and he could tell you exactly what it was going to mean to you. He could also explain and tell you exactly what was going to happen to you if you went against him.
That was the voice of CBS legend Bob Schieffer. Before we go to our first break, we're going to order breakfast. So, Kelly, if you'd be kind enough to join us here. Steve, what would you like?
I'm going to go with the Eggs Benedict.
Eggs Benedict, would you like that with bacon or cinnamon?
Bacon, please.
I'll have the breakfast wrap, no avocado, extra bacon, please.
I'll have the breakfast wrap with avocado, regular amount of bacon.
Okay. Regular amount.
What is the regular amount of bacon?
Whatever it is, it's going to be great.
Yeah, whatever her regular is, double that for me.
Save the avocado. I'll have the breakfast wrap with bacon.
Excellent. So you are listening to The Takeout. One of the things we want you to do, of course, is remember that new episodes of this Takeout are available every Friday morning, and we invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Go to takeoutpodcast.com. Follow us, like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. That's at takeoutpodcast.com. I'm Major Garrett, coming to you from the St. Gregory Hotel. You are listening to The Takeout.
Right now, we're not getting along with Russia at all. We may be at an all-time low in terms of relationship with Russia. I said, the way you're going to make a good trade deal is to help us with North Korea. Otherwise, we're just going to go it alone. That'll be all right, too.
That was the voice of President Trump at his East Room press conference with the Secretary General of NATO dealing with Russia and China and North Korea. Bob, I want to ask you, again, based on your long experience watching the American presidency, a lot of presidents come in with all sorts of aspirations, understandably, to fix to their liking the domestic agenda, and almost immediately or eventually foreign policy becomes, if not an obsession, a central focus, because that's really where the principal power of the presidency actually resides. Are we seeing that with President Trump?
Yes, and so many times you do. Remember during the when George W. Bush ran for president, I think there was only one serious foreign policy speech made during that campaign, and I think it was made by John McCain. There were no speeches made on terrorism, and we know what dominated the Bush presidency. It was terrorism from start to finish because of 9/11. You're seeing much the same thing. I must say, hearing President Trump tweet yesterday about what President Xi had told him during their consultations. Normally, you don't hear that.
Right.
And I wonder what the reaction to that is going to be in China. And is that going to make it easier for President Xi to help out on North Korea? Now, maybe the two of them had an agreement and said, look, we're going to work on this North Korea thing, and We're going to let everybody know about it. But I didn't hear President Xi say anything about it. And I wonder if other foreign leaders will now be more reluctant about what they speak to the president about in private. It seems to me that that was something that I think normally presidents would have kept undercover.
And, Nancy, this brings up something that I've detected about the Trump presidency, and it was certainly something I detected covering the Trump campaign. Donald Trump loves the telephone. He works the phone all the time, 30, 40, 50 calls a day, relentlessly. That's how he gathers information. That's how he gathers intelligence. That's how he takes stock of people, situations, and collects information. And my experience talking to people on Capitol Hill is that the president calls members of Congress so much more than President Obama did, or even President George W. Bush, even President Clinton.
Right.
And this is part of what you get with Donald Trump. Lots of conversations that sometimes are going to not leak out. He's just going to talk about what he just talked about.
Right. And it's amazing the number of people that you hear about who the president talks with on the phone 3 times a week. How is he talking to all of these people 3 or 4 times a week? I don't talk to my own family that much.
He did say that they have a beautiful telephone system at the White House. So maybe.
But
you can literally get anybody on the line anywhere in the world anytime you want.
It was interesting with that conversation with the Chinese leader. You know, there's a lot of talk, and you've experienced this firsthand, about how the White House is still getting up to speed. After that conversation happened, the White House put out a one-sentence statement about the conversation, said it was productive, and they had a good talk. The Chinese government put out a one-page statement about everything that they discussed, and it was remarked upon that it's not that often that the Chinese government is more forthcoming than the U.S. government, and it may be that he was stung by that criticism, which is why he started, you know, taking to Twitter to describe more aspects of their conversation.
But, you know, talking about what you talked to the Chinese president about is one thing. Calling members of Congress, I think that is nothing but good. Yeah. I mean, members of Congress love nothing more than telling constituents, well, as the president said to me the other day, I mean, this is the coin of the realm for Congress. Lyndon Johnson, I mean, he talked to members of Congress a lot more than even Donald Trump is.
Listen
talking
to the
to
tapes.
Them.
They're all there.
It's not to draw there. A direct parallel to Lyndon Johnson. But, you know, we joke around and you say that I've never seen anything like this before in my life. Mm-hmm. But are there any parallels to previous presidents that you see in Donald Trump? Any parallels?
No, I think it's all a new world here. I mean, but we're in a new world, and that's the part we have to remember. I mean, three things happened that brought Donald Trump to the presidency. The nation was locked in a deep partisan gridlock. The divide has never been deeper or wider in modern times than it is now. The political parties had less influence than at any time in modern history, and for the first time nominated two candidates that a majority of the American people neither liked nor trusted. And all of that was playing out while we were undergoing this profound change in our culture brought on by the change in communications and the coming of the digital age. All three of those things come together at once, and is it any surprise that we're seeing a different kind of presidency emerge out of that?
I think we have a montage that will, I believe, add some audio weight to what you just said, Bob.
That's something different for us.
I have never seen anything like this campaign.
It was totally different than any that I've seen. I mean,
but this, I must say, is the first time I've seen.
That's not what the American electoral process is all about.
I must say, this was a different kind of debate. I'd never seen anything quite like that.
I think we're seeing something, we may see something more profound happen than just this race.
So wait, have you seen anything like this before?
No. We're not clear, Bob. Have you seen this
but
before?
Here's a question, though.
I did not know that was coming, by the way.
Somebody who's covered this for decades. The pendulum swings, right? We've seen the pendulum swing. Yeah. And it's swung in a direction, and so far, than we've ever seen before. Do you think, what's your sense over the next few years? Is there an opportunity for the pendulum to sort of swing back to more normalcy? Or have we just gone in a direction that we're not turning back from?
You know, there was a profound change in the culture after the invention of the printing press. And for the most part, that was really, really good. But there were also 30 years of religious wars that came after that. Ann Applebaum of the Washington Post remarked at one point that eventually equilibrium was reached. We're not there yet. We're not there yet.
And Nancy, when Bob talks about, as he mentioned just a moment ago, the partisan divides, how it visited itself upon the presidential campaign, it is, if anything, not only visiting itself and has visited itself upon Congress, but appears to be becoming not only more visible, but more threatening to the institutional norms of the way Congress has always worked. And there are a lot of people now who wonder, are we beginning to see a transformation of the fundamental relationships in Congress that may change that institution forever? Do you think it's that big, what we're seeing going on right now?
Sure. There are a lot of troubling signs, but I sort of see it on a continuum of this breakdown in bipartisanship that we've been witnessing for years now. You can look at the nuclear option being exploded back in 2013. You can look at the government shutdowns. You know, you can look at the prospect of a government shutdown this summer. You know, you can look at the fact that John Boehner was run out of town, essentially, by members of his own party. And now Paul Ryan, who a few years ago we would have all said is one of the most conservative members of Congress, and now he's not sufficiently conservative for a powerful flank of his party. There are a lot of troubling
signs.
And
Nancy, remind our audience what the nuclear option means. Because a lot of people in Washington toss it around, assuming everyone in the country understands what it means. Mm-hmm. It has this very alarming metaphorical sound to it. What does it mean, and what did we just? How did we just see it play out just a couple of weeks ago?
So the House and the Senate operate differently. The House is a straight up majority rule. You need 50% plus one to win on any piece of legislation. In the Senate, they operate differently. You need 60 votes to move to a piece of legislation or to a presidential appointment. And that was done for a reason. The founders wanted the Senate to be a more deliberative body where you needed buy-in from both sides, no matter who was in charge. Well, back in 2013, Democrats were frustrated. They were in the majority back then. Republicans were blocking a record number of the president's appointments, and they said, you know what? We are going to explode what's always been known as the nuclear option, which means we're going to get rid of that 60-vote threshold when it comes to presidential appointments, not when it comes to legislation, not when it comes to Supreme Court nominees, but any presidential appointment, you're now only going to need 51 votes. And that was pretty cataclysmic because that's the whole reason that the Senate operates the way it does. And if you get rid of the imperative for the two sides to work together in the Senate, you end up with even more gridlock than we have now.
That's the voice of Nancy Cordes. You are listening to the Takeout Podcast, episode 13 of this humble audio odyssey. We are coming to you from the St. Gregory Restaurant and Hotel, right across the street from the CBS News Bureau. Oh, and actually, we're in the restaurant. The restaurant has a very particular name. And because I can't pronounce it, the world's greatest podcast sidekick.
Did you not take foreign language in high school?
I did, but not that particular
one. I'm not sure.
One.
I think this is Italian. Tradici Enoteca is the name of this restaurant. We should give them a shout out because they've been great hosts so far.
And before we leave you, we will actually translate what those two words mean. I can't do it right now. I'm Major Garrett. You are listening to The Takeout. Musical stylings of Bob Schieffer sounding a lot like Johnny Cash there for a second, at least to my ear. I'm Major Garrett. This is episode 13 of The Takeout. 13 seems to be the number of this entire audio odyssey this week. Steve Shigaris, say one more time the name of the restaurant we are in at the St. Gregory Hotel in Washington, D.C.
Tradici Enoteca.
Right. Tradici is 13, we have since discovered, in the Renaissance language of Italian.
We are
recording this on April 13th. Mm-hmm. It's the 13th episode, and we are in 13, and the second word, say it one more time.
Enoteca.
Wine bar. We'll get to that part later. joined by Bob Schieffer and Nancy Cordes, my CBS News colleagues. We're going to talk some fun stuff now about pop culture, personalities, meaning the lives and things that are entertaining and interesting to our two guests. Steve Shigaris, take us on our merry way.
Well, so I'm not sure our audience knows that Nancy is a native of Hawaii, which under Barack Obama's presidency became a more known place. But to me, it was always exotic growing up. This is what I knew about Hawaii growing up. Hawaiian Punch, Magnum P.I., mm-hmm. and the Brady Bunch episodes in which the tiki that they were all wearing brought them bad luck. That's pretty much Hawaii, right?
It's all tikis.
That's it? Is that all it is? Tell us about what was it like growing up in Hawaii in the 80s?
And for those of us of a certain age, Hawaii 5-0.
Hawaii 5-0, yes. Well, which Magnum basically replaced.
Exactly.
That's another story.
I think I babysat for his kids a couple of times.
Tom Selleck.
It's a small place.
Really?
Yeah. Well, let's see. As a little girl, you grow up dancing hula rather than ballet.
Not listening to country music.
No, Hawaiian music.
And you are a skilled hula dancer, are you not?
I've maintained some of my skills. Maybe if we come back to the wine bar later.
We'll bring the cameras.
I can show some of those off. No, it's just, you know, it's gorgeous and warm and friendly and laid back. And what did I do wrong to end up 5,000 miles away from there? I have no idea.
Now, do you think it's felt that way by people born there? Because I've talked to many people who have moved from the mainland to Hawaii, and mm-hmm. they have a hard time adjusting.
Yes,
they love it for
island
the first
fever.
6 months. They love it mm-hmm. for the first 6 months or a year. But then the sense of isolation
yep.
creeps in.
For a lot of people, it's hard to be so far away from their family. And they think they're going to move to paradise and it's going to solve all of their problems. And there are a lot of people who just can't handle it. Hawaii is literally the most isolated place on Earth. You are 2,500 miles from anything. There's no place else on Earth that, you know, that has that kind of feeling. And so for a lot of people, it does tend to be just too far away. But for someone who grew up there and who still has family there and has friends there, you don't quite have the same sensation.
Bob, you grew up in another paradise known as Fort Worth, Texas. I consider myself
mainland paradise.
Yes, I consider myself an honorary Texan. My father was born in Baytown, Texas. My first job was in Amarillo, Texas. My third job was in Houston, so I'm not a Texan by birth, but I'm a Texan by sort of experience. Having grown up in Texas, that's a unique place in America. Every Texan will tell you that. When you're in the state, even if you're not from there, you notice lots of differences. How did Texas shape you as a human being? How does it shape you as a journalist?
Well, and you talk about being a unique place, and Fort Worth is a unique place in Texas. We always say, you know, if you want to see Atlanta, go to Dallas. If you want to see Texas, come to Fort Worth. That's where the Cowboys are. Fort Worth is, and I used to work at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Across the headline, the top of the paper, it said Fort Worth, where the West begins. And in Fort Worth, we also say in Dallas, that's where the East peters out. But the reason they called it where the West begins is there was a line of forts, you know, that were across the West because of the Indians. So once you got past Fort Worth, you were in Indian territory. And these were the Apaches, and these were the Comanches. So Fort Worth, those forts were very, very important. And, you know, Texas was not really that much of a part of the Civil War. Sam Houston was impeached because he refused to secede as the governor of Texas. But what happened was when the Civil War came, all the federal soldiers went east to fight in the Civil War, and so the Indians came back, and that caused that was a creation of the Texas Rangers, who were the Indian fighters. The part that shaped me as a journalist most was working at the Star-Telegram. I was a police reporter, and I worked under a very good editor. That's where I learned how to be a reporter. And I think most of what I learned about journalism, I learned there. And I'm always be grateful for that.
That's a similar experience for me. I worked at the Amarillo Globe News. I was a cop reporter there, then went to the Las Vegas Review-Journal, worked as a cop reporter there for 2 years, so 4 years of covering cops, and then a little bit of that at the Houston Post. So, Bob, you and I have one thing in common, at least, is that starting in our careers, we were newspaper reporters, and then either graduated or devolved into broadcast journalism. I'll leave it to our audience to decide which it is.
Well, I couldn't spell. That's why I got into broadcasting.
Did newspapering make a difference for you as a broadcaster?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I still love it. I still love writing. I mean, as you know, I kind of like art a lot, and I think the basis of all art is drawing. And I think the basis of all journalism is writing. And I think you have to learn how to be able to sum up your thoughts in a couple of sentences. And that served me well down through the years.
I covered the crime beat at KHNL, Hawaii News 8. Yes. And they always had a very high closure rate because you have to be pretty dumb to commit a crime in Hawaii because there's no place to run.
Escape routes quite limited.
And so they caught up with those guys real fast.
But, you know, the thing about it, covering police is the best training that you can have in journalism.
Why?
Every story you walk into is the worst moment in someone's life. Every story. It's not like being a sports reporter where, you know, you go and they have a nice seat for you and somebody to help you with the stats. They're happy to have you. Nobody wants you there when you're the police reporter. And if you can learn to conduct your business and get it done and do it in a respectful way and get the facts under those circumstances, you're not going to be cowed by some on-the-make politician.
Bob has one of my all-time favorite journalism stories when you worked at the Star-Telegram. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
On November 22nd, 1963. Can you tell us that story real quick?
Well, to capsule it, it was total bedlam. I worked at the Star-Telegram. That was the day President Kennedy had been shot in Dallas. He had spent the night in Fort Worth. I got up. I was sound asleep because I didn't get off work until 3 o'clock in the morning. And so when the shooting happened in Dallas, I was still asleep, as I normally would be. My brother woke me up. I got down to the office, and I was just trying to help him answer the phones on the city desk. And a call came in, and a woman said, "Is there anybody there who could give me a ride to Dallas?" And I said, "Well, lady, you know, we don't operate a taxi here, and besides, the president's been shot." And I was about to hang up the phone, and I hear this voice say, "Yes, I heard on the radio, I think my son is the one that they've arrested." It was Lee Harvey Oswald's mother. I forgot that part about not operating a taxi. Wrote down her number and went
out to her house, service right
took
away.
Took her to Dallas and stayed with her throughout the day. And
until you were found out.
Yeah. And what happened was, long about dark, she said, "I wonder if they would let me talk to my son." And I said, "I don't know." So I went to Captain Will Fritz, who I didn't know. I mean, I'd never set foot in the Dallas police station. That was 30 miles from Fort Worth. And he said, "You know, we probably ought to do that." And they did that in those days. For one thing, they didn't want people to think they'd beaten up the prisoner and so forth. So anyway, we're all herded into this little holding room off the jail, and they're going to bring him down to talk to his mother. And I think, my God, I'm going to get to hear this. Maybe I'll get to interview him. And finally, a guy stood over in the corner and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Are you a reporter?" And I said, "Well, yes." And he said, "You get out of here."
He should have said you were a cab driver.
He said, if I ever see you again, I'm going to kill you. I mean, he was furious. But it was just turned out it was an FBI agent doing what someone should have done. Right. That was the first person who asked me who I was. In those days, if you kind of looked like you could belong someplace, nobody said much about it.
Bob, you talked a moment ago about putting the words together on the fly, in the moment. That's one of the requirements of being exceptional in this business. Nancy Cordes does it all the time. I want to play something that Nancy said the morning after the election.
The mood at that election party last night was astounding, going from upset at the end, where at first they had been jubilant. They were crying. They were shell-shocked. They were hugging each other for support as the night went on. This campaign had been so sure of victory based on its data that at 8 p.m., they told us she was putting the finishing touches on one of the two speeches they had prepared for her, a sign they all believed that she had won and might even be declaring victory on the early side.
Hard to get a better encapsulation of the emotional ups and downs of election night within the Hillary Clinton campaign headquarters. That, I would imagine, Nancy, will go down in your career, which has many, many years ahead of it, as one of the most memorable moments.
It was a crazy night. You know, we were there in the Javits Center, which had been selected because of its glass ceiling that everyone on both sides, for the most part, assumed would be shattered that night. The campaign was very chatty in the beginning of the night, telling us she's feeling really good. She's looking at two copies of the speech. Now she's only looking at one. She's making the finishing touches. On the victory speech. And then suddenly they went silent. And nobody could get a hold of them. All the reporters were looking at each other saying, well, do you know what's going on? Do you know what's going on? Nobody will talk to me. Nobody will. And then they came up. They surfaced for a moment after she lost Florida and North Carolina. And they said, well, that was never our path. You know, we've got another path. And then they went quiet again. And we couldn't get them for another hour. And in the meantime, it was almost as if the supporters and volunteers in the room knew what was happening before the campaign itself did, because they all got quiet. They all got, you know, they started to have tears in their eyes. And then finally, I remember hearing from someone on the campaign who said, well, it isn't over yet in Wisconsin. We still have a chance, but we're not delusional either. And that's when I realized, this is it. She's losing.
And could you see in their faces something that you'd never seen before? Because that was a pretty confident campaign.
Oh, yes. I mean, they were, shell-shocked would not even begin to describe it. I mean, they all were so organized on the Clinton campaign that everybody in the top echelon knew what their job was going to be after Election Day. You know, they had the entire org chart already established.
For the transition and the White House
for
itself.
For the White House itself. And so, you know, if you find out within the space of an hour that not only is this person who you have worked so hard for and you are so convinced you've nailed it down has lost, but your entire livelihood is now thrown into jeopardy. And this man who you believe is a danger to the Republic has now won, and you are somehow responsible for allowing him to win. I mean, there was a lot of strong emotion in that.
Bob, I'm going to give you the last word. An inherent danger for any presidential campaign to have that much of the administration yet to be that planned out?
Yes. And you know, the other part of this is I was just listening to Nancy here. There is no place that surpasses the emotions that are felt, highs and lows, that will match what happens on an election night or during a campaign. Because people, it's impossible to describe unless you've been a part of one of these things. And that's why it's such a great experience to have the opportunity to cover a campaign, to see this sort of thing happen. I can't think of anything where people get more excited or are just simply crushed when they lose. And I would also add one thing. I think the surprise in that room was matched by the surprise in the other room where you were, Major Garrett, because I am told by some that some of Donald Trump's pollsters, not all, but some, gave him no more than a 20% chance of winning. I think they were as surprised at the outcome as perhaps the Clinton people were.
Well, as we wrap this up, I will just say this. In that room, at the Hilton in Midtown Manhattan, at the same time that Hillary Clinton was polishing up her victory speech, meaning that hour between 7 and, let's say, 8 o'clock or maybe 7 to 8:30 on election night, Donald Trump was working through the mental preparation for a concession speech, because his people were very deeply nervous about what they saw coming out of Florida and North Carolina, and they knew if neither of those states came up on the board, they were going to lose, and it might be an early night. There was this crazy 90 minutes where both campaigns were drawing the same conclusion about what was going to happen, and it didn't happen to either, and both found themselves enormously surprised as the evening wore on. Bob Schieffer and Nancy Cordes have been our guests, proving that there is nothing perilous about putting three 13s together, as we have done for the 13th episode of the Takeout Podcast. As you know, new episodes arrive every Friday morning, and we definitely invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Go to takeoutpodcast.com. Follow us, of course, on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Hate the show? Love the show? Want to vent? Well, you can do all of that at takeoutpodcast@cbsnews.com. I'm Major Garrett, joined as always by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris. Steve, thank you.
No, thank you, Major.
No, Steve, always thank you. You have been listening to The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
We had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen.